Come into this place of peace and let its silence heal your spirit. Come into this place of memory and let its history warm your soul. Come into this place of prophecy and power and let its vision change your heart. Please join me in reading the unison chalice lighting, number 453, in the hymn book.
May the light we now kindle inspire us to use our powers to heal and not to harm, to help and not to hinder, to bless and not to curse, to serve you, Spirit of Freedom.
Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing hymn number 347, Gather the Spirit.
Gather the Spirit, harvest the power, our separate fires will kindle one flame. Witness the mystery of this hour, our trials in this light appear all same. Gather in peace, gather in thanks, gather in sympathy now and then, gather in hope, compassion and strength, gather to celebrate once again.
This story comes from Ken Collier, who's a longtime Unitarian Universalist minister, just recently retired from the Unitarian Society of Santa Barbara. Ken has written a number of stories centered on Coyote, who he claims is God's dog. How Coyote lost his songs, music, and dance. Here's a new story about Coyote. One day, it occurred to him that he didn't need any of the other creatures. There he was, sitting pretty all by himself. What did he need anyone else for? He had his songs, his flute, and drum, and his fire. He had his dancing, and his huge teepee. Besides, all the other creatures were kind of strange. There was Rabbit, with his huge ears and enormous legs, and all he ever did was run around. And there was Moose, with that absurd head of antlers wandering up to his knees in marshes. And there are all those pesky birds, flitting around, twittering, and never letting Coyote nap. Ridiculous. Who needed them? Not Coyote. So he decided to just leave them all behind. He picked himself up and wandered off, trying to find a place where he could be alone. Entirely alone, with none of these silly and absurd creatures to bother him, where he could dance his dances by himself and sing and play his flute and drum for no one but himself, a place where he wouldn't have to share his fire and he could nap in peace. As Coyote was leaving, Rabbit happened to see him and tagged along. At first he ran ahead with his big legs, and then he ran back, and then ahead, and then back. Coyote ignored him, hoping he would just go away. "Hey, Coyote," Rabbit yelled, "where are you going?" Coyote ignored him. Rabbit ran on ahead and came back. "Hey, Coyote," he said, "you know what's on the other side of that hill?" "I do, I just saw it." Coyote was curious, but he ignored Rabbit and just kept on walking. Rabbit ran on ahead and came back. "Hey, Coyote," he said, "there's something over there where you're headed, and you ought to know about it. I just saw it. Want me to tell you about it?" Well, Coyote did want to know, but he just ignored Rabbit, hoping he would go away and leave him alone. Ridiculous, Rabbit. Rabbit's feelings were a bit hurt. "Coyote, you know what? You're crazy." And he went away. That night, a funny thing happened. Coyote stopped and built his fire and sat down to sing, as he did every night. But as hard as he couldn't remember any of his songs. And so all he could do was play his flute and drum and dance a little. But he couldn't sing, and the night was strangely quiet. The next day, Coyote was off again, feeling a little sad and a little strange. But he still wanted to get away from these ridiculous creatures with their absurd ways of being. Before long, he came to a marsh. It was so wide, he didn't see how he would go around it. And shrugging his shoulders, he started to go through it. Pretty soon, he ran into Moose, who was, as usual, up to his knees in mud and weeds. Moose lifted his huge head of antlers when he saw Coyote coming. "Well, hello, Coyote," he said. "What brings you way out here to the marshes?" Coyote ignored him and kept looking for a way to cross the mud. Moose swung his great head this way and that, a little miffed that Coyote was ignoring him. "Coyote, if you're looking for a dry path, I could help you," he said. Coyote looked right at him and said nothing. What a ridiculous creature, Coyote thought to himself. If I had such silly things growing out of my head, I wouldn't let anyone see them. Moose's feelings were really hurt by now. "You know what, Coyote, you're crazy." And Moose walked away. Coyote finally did find his way across the marsh and went on. That night, something strange happened. Again, Coyote built his fire and tried to make his music, but not only had he forgotten his songs, now he couldn't remember how to play his flute and drum. All he could do was dance around the fire, and the night was frighteningly silent. The next day, Coyote was really upset and a little afraid, but he had decided that he would get away from all these silly creatures. And get away he would, so he set off again. This time he came to a little stream that flowed down out of the mountains. All along its banks were bushes and flowers, and it was beautiful and still and cool. And since he was thirsty and a little tired, Coyote took a long drink, sat down, decided to take a nap. As they often are, the bushes were filled with birds. And just as Coyote was about to go to sleep, the little birds started singing their songs. This was exactly what he wanted to get away from. It really made him angry that the birds wouldn't let him sleep in peace. And he was a little afraid and jealous that they could sing, and he had forgotten his songs and even how to sing. And so he leaped up and snarled and barked at them to frighten them away, and he succeeded. They flew up and off. But one bird, a little braver than the others, said to him, being careful to fly just out of his reach, "Coyote, you're crazy." And off she went. Coyote was kind of pleased with himself for getting rid of the birds, and so he decided to stay right there. That night he made his fire, but the strangest thing happened. Not only could he no longer sing, not only could he no longer play his flute and drum, but now he couldn't even remember how to dance. All Coyote could do was stare into the silent fire and think about how much he had lost. Finally, he fell asleep and dreamed. And in his dream, White Buffalo Woman appeared to him and asked him why he was so sad and scared. Coyote explained how he had lost his songs and music and dance. He didn't know what to do, and he was afraid that he would also lose his fire. White Buffalo Woman asked him why he was out here all alone. Coyote explained that he was tired of being surrounded all the time by those silly creatures who looked strange and acted strange and lived such ridiculous lives, and he had decided that he would live by himself away from it all. Coyote, said White Buffalo Woman, don't you understand that your music and your dance and even your fire are nothing but the spirits of those creatures who are different from you? As you drove them away, they left even your heart and took their spirits with them. If you want your music and dance back, you must go back to your friends and accept them back into your heart. Only then will you be able to go on. The next morning when Coyote awoke, he couldn't remember his dream, but when the birds began to sing, as they always do in the morning, he sat still and listened to them. And then he began to go back the way he had come. That night when he built his fire, he could remember his dance. And the next day he went off back the way he had come and chanced upon Moose. And he asked Moose how to get across the marsh. That night when he built his fire, he remembered how to play his flute and drum, and the night was not so lonely. And the next day he still went back the way he had come, and suddenly up ran Rabbit. Coyote ran with Rabbit and played and had a good old time. Probably went to a picnic. And that night when he had built his fire, the air was filled with Coyote's songs. And never again did Coyote forget how easily he could lose his music and his dance and even his fire.
Freely we have received of gifts that minister to our needs in body and spirit. Gladly we bring our church and its wide concerns a portion of this bounty. We will now take up the offering. We invite first-time visitors to please let the plate pass you by, as your presence here is gift enough. I would like to read for you this morning two poems, to be followed by a moment of silent meditation. The first is The Peace of Wild Things by Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound and fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time I rest in the grace of the world, and I am free. The next poem is Let Us Be at Peace by Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh. Let us be at peace with our bodies and our minds. Let us return to ourselves and become wholly ourselves. Let us be aware of the source of being common to us all and to all living things. Evoking the presence of the great compassion, let us fill our hearts with our own compassion towards ourselves and towards all living beings. Let us pray that we ourselves cease to be the cause of suffering to each other. With humility, with awareness of the existence of life and of the sufferings that are going on around us, let us practice the establishment of peace in our hearts and on the earth.
The sermon this morning is a reading. You can imagine since Friday evening that might not have been time to write something. This is a chapter from a book written by someone who must be a relative of mine, Tom Owen Toll. There aren't that many of us in the world. Tom has been co-minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of San Diego for 24 years. The book is titled Growing a Beloved Community, 12 Hallmarks of a Healthy Congregation. In his preface, he says, rather than focus on the dumb and destructive things our parishes do, which are all too familiar, I've chosen to accentuate the positive, arouse the possibilities, and spur us on toward the very best we can become. The chapter is called Practice Respect, and it takes about 10 minutes, so if you'll stay with me for that long a period, I think we will all learn something from it. He begins the chapter with a quote from John Stoltenberg, who's, I don't know, some of you may. The quote is, "Justice between people is perhaps the most important connection people can have. I now begin to realize the difference in my own life between acting in one's self-interest and acting in the interest of one's own best self." Tom starts his chapter. If we fail to be practitioners of right relations in our chosen tribes, then our admirable pronouncements and contributions in the larger society are bogus. In actuality, it may be far tougher to practice our Unitarian Universalist principle of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations in our families and congregations than anywhere else. In the Hebrew scriptures, Nathan must have been terrified to blow the whistle on King David, who had caused the death of Uriah so that he could wed Uriah's wife. But Nathan appealed to David's basic goodness by posing a moral question that nudged David to repentance. As we can see, prophets, the brave ones, dare to confront fraud, incompetence, bigotry, relational abuse, and other life problems, not only in the larger world, but more significantly in their own backyards. Tom continues, "I remember a colleague fervently goading her congregation to become change agents. When she continued to press the issue, some congregants were perturbed and rose up saying, 'Reverend Joan, we agree with your prophetic message, but we didn't expect you to target us. Why, we thought you were going to give hell to the folks out there, not to us in here.' The number of futile squabbles in our congregations between religious professionals and laity and among lay members is astonishingly high. We must do better by and with one another as collaborators in strengthening our beloved communities. We desperately need to learn how to argue more constructively as Unitarian Universalists. During my seminary days," and these are Tom's words, "there was nary a word on the ticklish topic of church fights. Today there are plentiful volumes, both incisive and broad, on how to use conflict to best advantage. All Souls Unitarian Church in Colorado Springs, Colorado has generated a covenant of beloved community, replete with collective vision and an agreed upon code of conduct for co-creating a healthy fellowship. The church has also instituted a thoughtful process for reconciliation, healing, and resolution for those times when its mutually shaped norms are violated. This parish also has a beloved community team that helps keep congregational behavior on course and ensures that every newcomer recognizes right off the bat that," and here's a quote, "All Souls is a safe haven that nurtures and enhances personal and spiritual growth. We are a welcoming place where those in our community respect themselves and others. We are a shelter of many beliefs where a minority and opposing views are accepted and respected. Being a member of a beloved community requires learning and practice." And Tom adds, "We should add forgiveness." How can Unitarian Universalist parishes foster right relationships? First, they need to learn how to embrace conflict as inevitable, even desirable. Every viable organization, and a church is no exception, both yearns for stability and pushes for achievement. Harmony is in constant tension with adaptation to new circumstances. Progress is both expansive and disruptive. Progress spells change. Change causes anxiety. Anxiety precipitates conflict. But conflict is not only unavoidable, it's beneficial. Hearty turmoil elicits new ideas and understandings. It's the fire in which a vibrant parish is tempered. As one person said to an adversary in a church fight, "Thank you for being such a pain. You've come to me as a teacher." A lack of visible conflict cannot be taken to indicate that congregational life is stable or free from disruptive strains. Indeed, in a church whose organizational structure is tenuous, members may well avoid conflict, fearing that it might endanger the group's continued existence. So congregants walk on eggs. They sweep controversies under the rug or store them in the closets if there's room. Ironically, genuine conflict frequently emerges in eras of strength, when a community is swelling in size or morale and is strong enough to tackle the problem. A healthy church learns to integrate the focus of stability within the forces of change. It can bicker gainfully. Opposing opinions can actually create a golden opportunity that is for a church equipped with goodwill, turning conflict into growth. Some congregations are bedeviled by passive-aggressive behavior where folks never squarely address their conspicuous differences, or by constant warfare where interludes of peace are rare. But on the whole, most of our liberal religious outposts dwell someplace in between, where people are sometimes difficult, and conflicts are real and persistent, but possible to face. Healthy churches lift up the pain, create covenantal guidelines, and point fellow members in the direction of managing conflicts, if not resolving them. They learn how to fight fairly, not cruelly, for impact, not injury. Healthy churches heed what Native American activist Catherine Atla calls the big law of respect. A respectful church is one where boundaries are kept, saboteurs are confronted, crises are faced. Good behavior is expected and rewarded. Parishioners are urged from the moment they sign the membership book to engage one another with an active gaze and a level glance. No, it reaches even farther back than that. Respect must be evident in the details of church organization and programming from the moment a newcomer crosses the threshold. In a healthy church, members are always asking, what does it mean to practice a kinder regard? Whether we are engaged in religious education or social outreach, maintenance, or leadership development, liturgy, or fundraising. To be respectful literally means to look at something or someone again. The Buddhists call this process seeing with unfurnished eyes. That is, eyes empty of mental clutter and inherited furniture. Respectful persons are those who look again at what is readily ignored or missed. They review outworn, debilitating church patterns and consider developing new institutional habits. They stand firm against any conduct that will subvert the beloved community. They produce safe congregation policies to protect children, youth, and adults from abusive behaviors. And perhaps most critically, they look again at their own motives before casting judgment on other folks in the congregation. Indeed, what would it take for us to see the holy or the divine in each person with whom we tussle in congregational life? The Hindu salutation Namaste roughly translates as, "I honor that which is sacred in you," or "that place where you and I are one." Practice saying that to yourself as you greet, engage, and tangle with the folks in your faith community for a day, a week, for always. Still another way of fostering right relationships in our churches is to risk compromising. Religious peacemaker Thich Nhat Hanh suggests inhabiting a state of non-stubbornness, where we abandon our set agenda in order to entertain opposing viewpoints. Unquestionably, the most difficult thing in up-close relationships like partnership, family, or church is to relinquish our sense of being correct, being in control, being the good guy or gal in fair or foul weather. The prize of beloved community requires placing shared satisfaction over hanging onto one's sense of personal virtuousness. Backbone and tenacity are certainly virtues, but they wreak havoc in a parish when plated with an air of haughtiness or rigidity. You can sense a nasty stalemate looming whenever we supposedly hold principles while the others merely harbor prejudices. Right relations in church life bank on individuals who are willing to resolve conflicts through compromise, not through bullying or even convincing another of the rightness of our position. Creative compromises don't always mean giving in to the other side, but they do mean giving up being right all the time. Each person promises to contribute something for the benefit of the greater institution instead of bolstering her or his own opinion or ego. Compromise clearly activates our imagination and often our deepest and most compassionate instincts. Journalist Barbara Walters pointedly asked Anwar Sadat years back, "What would it take for you to go to Jerusalem to meet with Menachem Begin?" Suddenly, Sadat was examining the obstacles to this goal in a new way. Imagination reminds us that something else besides stalemate or violence is possible. Compromise is the hallmark of the human species and a critical factor in our congregational ability to evolve. Only 15% of our brain is grown before birth. 85% develops afterwards. So we're far more adaptable than we may have imagined. As one analyst noted about the grand achievements of Eleanor Roosevelt, she mastered the art of compromising up. Church stewardship is committed to doing just that. Finally, congregants should hold themselves to what radical monk Thomas Merton called the vow of stability. Individual Unitarian Universalists may be devoted to a particular viewpoint in any given church conflict. We should be. Church life should encourage passionate rather than lukewarm stakeholders. But allegiance to the common values that establish our church's very being in the first place must always supersede our own personal positions. Our early Universalist forebrother, José Ballou, echoed the kind of respect that transcends self or personal outlook when he wrote in a treatise on atonement in 1805, "Let neighborly love continue. If we have love, no disagreement can do us any harm. But if we have not love, no agreement can do us any good." Every concerned church member has a responsibility to participate in family squabbles rather than duck and seek cover. To remain neutral in times of conflict is to cop out. Not to decide is to decide. Moral philosopher John Dewey put the problem vividly. Saints deliberate while burly sinners run the world. So church stakeholders must vow to enter the debating chambers, share their peace, listen to their table mates, then stay put. One recalls the Last Supper scene with Jesus and the 12 disciples. Jesus breaks bread, passes a cup, and says, "Someone here will betray me." It's a pretty painful subject to risk at such a time of fellowship. And Jesus was in fact betrayed by both Peter and Judas before the next day was over. Nonetheless, Jesus did not flee the scene. He took a deep seat. A healthy church urges us to stay at the table, even when our first impulse may be to disappear as quickly as possible amidst the flying fur. A vital parish candidly warns its constituents, "Yes, you will be frustrated here sometimes, bruised, perhaps even betrayed upon occasion. And how could it be otherwise? A church at its truest isn't a sweetheart festival. And congregants aren't a bunch of unblemished angels, but a batch of flawed earthlings. We do ugly things to one another outside the church. Why should we expect to receive preferential and perfect treatment inside these walls? Granted, there may be times when we feel compelled by conscience to leave our church over a serious issue. If, according to our deepest convictions, our chosen clan has broken faith with its very soul, we may be driven to say, bless you and goodbye. Thank you for all you've given me, but I must move on. I can no longer sincerely and affectionately pursue my religious path in your midst. But such a departure should be the last resort. The Navajo have a practice that illustrates staying at the table during times of glaring distress. When someone has violated a principle or person, the townsfolk gather to burn the offender's home down. Then, and here's the restorative twist, they regroup and alongside the violator, help to rebuild her or him a new home. If our churches seek to create safe, saving places for people who have wounded and been wounded, then it's both intelligent and courageous to take both symbolic and tangible action in cooperation with each other. It could entail role-playing, rearranging furniture, creating a wildly fresh plan, taking a walk, engaging in social protest, praying, planting trees, or even rebuilding a home.
I'm so grateful. Earth, cure me. Earth, receive my woe. Rock, strengthen me. Rock, receive my weakness. Rain, wash my sadness away. Rain, receive my doubt. Sun, make sweet my song. Sun, receive the anger from my heart. If here you have found freedom, take it with you into the world. If you have found comfort, go and share it with others. If you have dreamed dreams, help one another that they may come true. If you have known love, give some back to a bruised and hurting world. Go in peace. Namaste.